The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Science Weekly Extra. This is the full interview with the renowned Harvard University scientist Steven Pinker, whose work moves across a number of disciplines from linguistics to cognitive science and experimental psychology. He's the author of 6 scholarly works, including The Language Instinct, How the Mind Works, Words and Rules, The Blank Slate, and The Stuff of Thought. In his latest book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Pinker sets out to prove a seemingly simple but profound pattern about the nature of human psychology and society. He says that in relative terms, the world is becoming a less violent place, and that many common assumptions about the supposed increase in violence, well, they're just simply wrong. I started by asking him to lay out the evidence for his counterintuitive conclusion.
Yes, it has gone down over many scales of time and magnitude. The first was the transition from the life in a state of anarchy, which our species evolved, that is the tribal or hunting and gathering way of life, to the first settled states, which resulted in a reduction of the rate of violent death by about a factor of 5. Then as settled states began to coalesce and central authority became more consolidated in Europe, the homicide statistics, which in many parts of Europe go back centuries, show a decline of perhaps 30-fold from the Middle Ages to the present. During that period, there was another set of reductions of institutionalized violence, grisly forms of criminal punishment like burning at the stake, breaking on the wheel, disemboweling, practices like slavery, debtors' prisons, religious persecution, dueling, all were targeted for elimination in the 18th and 19th centuries, a process I call the humanitarian revolution. Then there were some more recent declines. The fact that interstate war and war involving developed states and great powers seems to have disappeared after the Second World War. That was the last spasm of war between states. More recently, in the last 20 years, war in the rest of the world has been in decline. Fewer people die in violent conflicts worldwide. And then there's violence on even smaller scales, such as lynching and racial pogroms, which have vanished from the West. Violence against women has been targeted by the women's movement, and rates of rape and domestic violence have gone down. Violence against children, such as paddling or strapping in schools, as well as spanking and smacking by parents, have been in decline. And more recently, people have turned their concern toward animals, and we've seen increased regulation of the treatment of animals in laboratories, an increase in vegetarianism, an increase in regulations on how farm animals may be treated.
In the 20th century, it's probably quite easy to record and find evidence for deaths in wars or homicide statistics and murders, etc. As you go further back in time, obviously it gets harder and harder to actually count data. So, you know, how many data points do you have as you go further back in time, and how robust are they? You talk in the book about stories in the Bible or tales of Mongolian conquests, but how easy is it to be accurate about the numbers of people that might have been killed imprisoned or whatever?
The farther back you go, clearly the more uncertainty there is, particularly when it comes to forms of violence other than deaths, which are discrete, easily countable, more easily classifiable. But there are quantitative historians who use techniques of numerical estimation, which are familiar to many scientists. For example, if you have a range of estimates and discard the ones that can be ruled out as totally implausible, take the geometric mean between the highest and the lowest, you're probably within an order of magnitude of the correct value. And there are ways that, by estimating, first of all, the population of an area at the time, looking at quantitative records that do exist, such as tax rolls, and governments have long been interested in how many people there are to extract taxes from. If the tax rolls show a sudden decline following a war that contemporaries described as destructive, the reduction in population is one way of estimating the death toll from a war.
And what about the times before even taxes? So hunter-gatherer societies where people lived in small bands. Again, there's virtually no records beyond cave paintings at some stage. stage. What do you do about sort of that sort of time?
Actually, there are records of two kinds. There's forensic archaeology that is examining prehistoric skeletons for signs of violent trauma, like the kind of fractures that today we know must have come from violence. And then there's ethnographic vital statistics, ethnographers who've lived with those peoples who have managed to avoid the wave of government that spread out of the first six cradles of civilization and continue to live in anarchy. The anthropologists who live with them for decades have recorded the causes of death, and you can see what percentage of them are from violent deaths.
So you document in the book that in the 20th century, despite in the 20th century there being so many terrible things, including the world wars, Pol Pot, etc., why do people still not believe that violence is going down?
Well, one is they are impressed by these outliers, the events of extreme violence, and continue to be impressed by concrete examples of violence that are fed to us every day in the news. And we know from cognitive psychology that the human mind estimates risk and probability by the ease with which it can recall examples from memory, the so-called availability heuristic discovered by Tversky and Kahneman. Since violence has not been eliminated, there are always enough incidents of violence to fill the evening news, no matter what the rate is. And so people's impressions will be disconnected from the actual proportions. The mind is not good at figuring out the denominator of the fraction, namely how many people and opportunities there are for violence to occur, and against which you calibrate the number that actually did occur.
So the saturation and increased coverage in media and newspapers and TV, this distorts the picture. I mean, that makes a lot of sense.
Together with, and there's a second reason, which is that we care more about violence today. So if violence takes place in some remote part of the world, it tugs on our conscience in a way it didn't in past centuries. And we continue to make our radar more sensitive for categories of violence that didn't even count as violence in the past, such as capital punishment. Nowadays, if the state of Texas executes some vicious serial killer, people consider the lethal injection to be a form of violence. 100 years ago, that wouldn't have been violence. That would have been justice. And likewise, the most recent category of violence that's been targeted for elimination is bullying on the playground. 25 years ago, that wouldn't have been violence. That would have been childhood. Boys will be boys. As we care about an expanding class of victims, our senses that violence has increased because it's easier to find, but that's just because there are more examples that we look for and care about.
So that leads me on to my next question, which is an impossibly hard sort of and big one. What have we been doing right?
Yes, that's what I try to identify in the book. One of them, I think, is outsourcing our dispute resolution to a third party, namely the government. This is the Hobbes's theory of the Leviathan. When you have a state and a judiciary and a police force with a monopoly on the use of violence, you do court the danger of the state inflicting violence on its citizens. On the other hand, by removing the incentive of citizens to inflict violence on one another, generally the rates of violence go down. Because, first of all, having a police force removes the incentives for exploitative attack by punishing aggression, but then it has a knock-on effect because not only are you deterred from aggression, but you know that your rivals are deterred from aggression as well. And that means that you can relax a bit. You don't have to contemplate a preemptive attack to do it to them before they do it to you. You don't have to maintain a stance of belligerence in order to deter attacks on you because the government's doing it for you. You don't need an implacable drive for vengeance, blood for blood, if the government is going to do your revenge for you. And since a third party is bound to come up with a more disinterested estimate of who's at fault and by how much than people with their self-serving biases, where everyone always thinks they're on the side of the angels and that their violence is justified retaliation, whereas the other guy's violence is naked, unprovoked aggression. Everyone always thinks that. Left to their own devices, you get cycles of vendetta and feuding. When you've got a third party making the judgments, it's more likely to be capped at one round.
I mean, that's in the ideal setting, of course. Governments are not always great at settling disputes and, in fact, get into disputes themselves. Police are not always beyond corruption, and many groups don't take part in either of those things. So how much of the decline can you say is accounted for the sort of civilizing process of what you just talked about? Because clearly lots of the world doesn't do that still.
Yes, although very little of the world is now in a state of anarchy. Our attention is riveted on those that are, like Somalia. The failed states, by definition, are places where the government isn't doing what it ought to do, namely deterring violence among its citizens. And sure enough, those are the places that make the headlines. Likewise, zones of anarchy that are controlled by drug lords, where they can't avail themselves of the dispute resolution apparatus of the state because what they're doing is illegal in the first place. And prohibited markets tend to exist in a state of anarchy, and they tend to be highly violent.
You mentioned earlier about preemptive attacking of enemies. And if we look in our sort of animalistic past, and we look at evolution and natural selection, attacking your enemies, if it makes sense, is a very good thing to do. It means you have more resources for you and your kin. Tennyson wrote about nature being red in tooth and claw, and Richard Dawkins uses that as a very powerful metaphor for how animals still today live. They're usually violent to each other. They destroy as much as they can to get resources. And in a sense, this is where we have come from. So isn't, in some sense, violence a natural phenomenon? Are we wired for it?
Yes, but we're also wired to inhibit violence under certain circumstances. There are parts of the brain that can act against those violent impulses. The better angels of our nature, in Abraham Lincoln's colorful phrase, which I co-opted as a title of the book. And whether violence actually breaks out depends on which of these impulses gets the upper hand. So on the one hand, we do have impulses like predation, just raw, naked aggression as a means to an end, dominance, revenge. On the other hand, we have self-control, we have empathy, we have a sense of fairness, we have cognitive processes that allow us to reason about the best way to live our lives, and the outcome of history depends on which components of human nature get to control behavior.
And so this is where it gets exciting for me, because we land squarely into evolutionary psychology mode now. So this battle between our cognitive processes, our minds are, as you say, constantly thinking and potentially inhibiting, or in some cases exacerbating our primal urges, if I can call them that. So what do we know about the inhibitory processes against violence? What are the sort of classic experiments that have been done in the last few decades to sort of try and understand how we try and stop ourselves from, you know, taking too much or murdering people or any of these things?
Self-control would be high on the list. And one of the knock-on effects of having the rule of law is not just that you know that Big Brother is watching you and is going to penalize you if you attack someone, but the so-called civilizing process is one where the presence of and acceptance of government gets people to generalize their self-control. Not only do they inhibit their tendency to attack or to lash out when the police officer is watching, but they become more controlled in general. And laboratory studies have shown that self-control generalizes, that if you force students to speak in grammatical sentences or to put away and wash their dishes after eating, they get better grades and they lose weight.
This is Victorian school children sort of method.
Indeed. And the Victorians, there's a grain of truth to that Victorian ideal of self-discipline. Also, we know that if self-control is relaxed, then tendencies towards violence can erupt. All of this is work by the psychologist Roy Baumeister. Now, you don't want a fist fight to break out in the lab, so you've got to use cleverer techniques. But Baumeister has shown that if you fatigue someone's self-control by, say, bringing them into the lab hungry and putting a plate of chocolate chip cookies in front of them that they're not allowed to eat, that tuckers out their self-control, and they are more likely in a second experiment immediately afterward to imagine themselves retaliating violently to some insult. They will punish a fake fellow subject with stronger electric shocks. They'll spike his food with hot sauce. They'll engage in all kinds of acts of mild violence as a result of their self-control being lessened.
Now, there are also experiments such as the famous Stanford prison experiment and, of course, the Milgram experiments, which investigate how people behave towards each other depending on whether they're told to behave in that way. I mean, can you take us through those two and how they might inform your thesis on the sort of maybe the decline in violence?
Yes, one of the phenomena of violence is that a lot of it is not a matter of an individual's motive, but people can become part of a social network that leads them to do things that they would never occur to them to do on their own. And we see these phenomena of madness of crowds in, for example, the rise of Nazism or communism, where people will collaborate with the government and do heinous things. And
their morals get renormalized, essentially.
That's
in
right.
some sense.
Well, the problem is that one of the moral sense is not the same as what we can morally justify. And doing a good job, being a good citizen, deferring to authority, not stepping out of line, themselves feel like moral virtues from the inside. And whether they do or not, sometimes behavior can be disconnected from moral standards, and people do things in the heat of the moment or under the pressure of the situation that they would never do if they felt free to reason it out from first principles. The Milgram experiment is the classic example in which an experimenter convinced subjects that they were in a learning experiment and that they had to administer shocks to a fellow subject who in fact was a paid confederate of the experimenter. And to everyone's surprise, 70% of the subjects delivered what they had reason to believe were fatal, could have been fatal shocks, at the very least were extraordinarily painful. And despite their own protestations, even though they knew that what they were doing was wrong and they were tormented by what they were doing, they did it anyway. And I think that does provide insight into the fact that in any society, people under the influence of other people can do things just fulfilling their social role that they could not morally justify.
I mean, that's an experiment that was done several decades ago. But does that shed light on your thesis about, I mean, the evidence is there, the violence has gone down, but how does that shed light upon the reasons for it?
For the decline?
Yeah.
Well, one of them is that we set up our social structure so that it's harder for someone to give orders to someone else that to do heinous acts. That is, if we have processes of review and responsibility and monitoring where you can't just do whatever you want, but there's enough transparency that the actions within an organization, such as an army or a corporation or a university, are open to scrutiny, we can prevent the situation from arising in which one person can order someone else to do horrible things. A second process, and this is scientifically up in the air, is whether people, having learned the lessons of history, are more likely to defy an authority who orders them to do unjustifiable things. There's been a recent replication of the Milgram experiment, which unfortunately had somewhat ambiguous results. The proportion of people delivering fatal shocks under the command of an experimenter in 2004 had declined from the levels of the 1960s when the original experiment was done, but not statistically significantly. So we don't really know whether there's been a real decline or not. You'd expect there to be something of a decline. We have bumper stickers that say question authority. Everyone knows about how indefensible it is to say I was just following orders, following the Nuremberg trials and other war crime trials. So you'd think the population would be a little less likely to knuckle under to a malevolent authority. And it might have, but the data aren't perfectly clear.
You talk in the book about something called a moralization gap. So the difference between what I think I'm doing in terms of moralizing, in terms of something being good, and what other people might think. Can you just explain that a little bit and how that creates some of the tensions that cause people to get angry or violent towards each other?
Yes, it's my summary of a great deal of research from social psychology that shows that everyone always believes that what they're doing is morally right, often even the most heinous acts. People rationalize by saying, well, anyone would do it in those circumstances. I was provoked. The victim deserved it. The victim didn't really suffer. Other people do worse things. We have a long list of rationalizations as to why we're really nice guys.
When you say rationalizations, you mean self-deception?
Yes, self-deception. That's right. And in fact, some clever experiments suggest that it really is self-deception and that deep down there may be some awareness that what you're doing is not justified, but it is well hidden by this tissue of rationalizations, which is in effect our PR campaign for how noble each one of us is in negotiations with others. But when you have two sides, each convinced that it is in the right, you can have cycles of violence where no matter how many acts of violence have been committed, one side believes that justice has been done. The other side believes that there's still a score to be settled.
One of the implications of that, I suppose, is, say, for example, in politics, if people are dogmatic, then usually one side will feel aggrieved if whatever the result. If one side will feel aggrieved, the other side seems to receive more. And you argue in the book that the rise of rationality, humanism, is critical thought, is an important reason for the decline of violence, i.e. if you can see the other person's point of view, then the world's a better place.
Yes, indeed. And this can work both at the emotional level of an expanded circle of empathy, that is, do you actually feel someone else's pain, but also at the cognitive level. Do you realize that it is irrational to favor your own interests over someone else's simply because there's nothing special about you compared to anyone else? Just because I'm me and you're you doesn't make it justifiable for me to exploit you, because I wouldn't like it if you exploited me. So if I'm going to persuade you, you shouldn't exploit me. I'm kind of sucked into a commitment that I shouldn't exploit you either if I want you to take me seriously. So there's something about rationality, especially in a collective forums where you exchange ideas, you negotiate, you have standards of free speech, of transparency, of peer review, of criticism. You have freedom of speech so that someone expressing a dissenting opinion isn't murdered. Given those circumstances, societies will move in certain directions rather than others. And the direction they'll move in is trying to minimize violence. Violence is a negative-sum game. Both parties would be better off if neither one committed violence against the other. It's always tempting to, if you can get away with violence, to commit it, because there are the ill-gotten gains. But to the extent that behavior is rationalized, is held to standards that you can write down and justify and enforce, that will tend to push toward toward the reduction of violence.
And that leads on to one of your angels. You have demons and angels at the end of the book to talk about the reasons why the violence is there and how we are trying, I suppose, to battle against it. And one of your angels is empathy. And you talk about the potential cognitive basis for it. And there's some really interesting new research going on into things like oxytocin, the hormone, the cuddle chemical,
yes.
And mirror neurons and things, which are both a mechanism in the brain to allow you to sort of feel kinship and warmth towards people. How much do we really know whether that's a real thing or whether it's just sort of tempting to think that it somehow exists in the brain, that there's a sort of empathy bit to your brain?
Yes. Mirror neurons are probably a red herring. They probably have nothing to do with empathy in the sense of compassion or sympathetic concern.
And these are neurons which are directed to copying behavior or feeling the same feelings as something, someone or something that you're looking at.
Probably. What we know about them literally is simply that they fire either when the animal executes a particular motion, like grasping, or when it sees another animal executing that action. It's been extrapolated to empathy, although the extrapolation is dubious. I think a better candidate is the oxytocin system, which does seem to correlate with various warm and cuddly and compassionate feelings. But there is reason to be skeptical of how much empathy powered the large-scale declines of violence. Because our sense of empathy, though it can be expanded, and there are experiments showing that if you read someone else's first-person account or listen to them, you then are more sympathetic to that person and the category that person represents. How strong those effects are is another story. And by default, our sense of empathy is triggered by cute little babies and fuzzy animals and our spouse and our brothers and sisters and our mothers. It can be expanded, but there are certainly limits. On the other hand, reason, that is the realization that there's nothing special about me, and whether or not I feel the pain of someone starving or being hacked to death in some remote part of the world, I know it's wrong. I know that it can't be justified. To get that going, you don't really have to feel their pain. You just have to know that it's indefensible to allow them to suffer. And the conclusion that I came to in the book, having reviewed the history of all of these declines, is that many of them were propelled more by reason than by empathy. Empathy can go only so far, but as you have a more rational, intellectualized society, there's some practices that just can no longer be justified. Not that empathy can't help the process along, but that it's ultimately reason and rationality that lead them to be eliminated.
Are there other biological triggers that might sort of explain bits of this decline too, or even explain violence itself? I mean, are there genes that are candidates for people being more violent, particularly, or even more caring? I mean, we know that testosterone, for example, is something that's a risk factor for people being violent, which is why, you know, the most risky chromosome to have is a Y chromosome, in terms of violence. That's right. The biggest risk factor, right?
Although testosterone doesn't make people violent so much as it makes them competitive, rising to a challenge. Dominance competitions are only one of several sources of violence, and they don't necessarily lead to violence. So it's certainly a risk factor, but testosterone is not a violence hormone directly.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, in terms of the genetics, then, are there leads to?
There are a number of them. In the violent direction, there is amount of testosterone and receptors for testosterone. There are enzymes that metabolize catecholamine neurotransmitters, and in some versions, they don't metabolize them as well, leaving people more prone to violence. MAOA gene, for example, has an allele that has been associated with violent outbursts.
This is the gene that was very common in certain populations in the South Pacific. Is that right?
There was a claim that it was of higher frequency in the Maori, the indigenous people of New Zealand, although there's a lot of uncertainty and controversy over that claim. More solid are claims that within a particular population, the individuals who have the particular allele of MAOA are more likely to get into trouble from impulsive violence. And one Dutch family where it was absent altogether, and there were it was inherited in a Mendelian pattern, and each of the people with the defective allele had a severe history of violence. Then there are also genes that may be associated with reduction in violence. It's possible that genes, for example, that expand the size or the connectivity of the prefrontal cortex would result in greater self-control. It's possible, there's reason to believe that whatever genes affect reasoning ability, namely intelligence, could indirectly lead the person to become less violent, holding all else constant.
Now, in the sort of 10,000 or so years that we're talking about in terms of the decline in people being murdered and so on, is it correct to say that the human mind has been the same in that entire time? Is there not a chance that cultural and genetic evolution has occurred in that time to pressure us towards the things you've found? So if for example people are particularly violent, then perhaps in the last few thousand years, they're the ones that have preferentially been taken out of society by being put in prison or killing themselves, in fact. Mm-hmm. So therefore, the ones who are less violent stay in the population. I wonder how much can you really say about the selection pressures going on in the last few millennia?
Yes, I consider that in some detail in the book. I come down on just on grounds of parsimony in saying that that there hasn't been a recent genetic change in humans for two reasons. Not to deny that there Could be. There absolutely could be. We don't know that there hasn't been. But there's no evidence that there has been. We know that some of the reductions in violence can take place over scales that are far too rapid to be attributable to natural selection, say over the last 20 years. Given that violence can come down that quickly through reasons that can't be genetic, one has everything one needs to explain the longer-term declines in violence that at least in principle could be genetic. Also, there is a way of testing that prediction, namely, if you think, for example, that living in a state society for large numbers of generations has weeded out tendencies towards violence, then that predicts that people who have lived in anarchy until recently, say hunter-gatherers, would be genetically more prone to violence than those who've lived in settled state societies. Now, that's clearly a hypothesis that has rather strong political and moral implications, which is one of the reasons that it may not be tested anytime soon. But it's also true that at least to a first approximation, probably a baby that was taken from a hunter-gatherer tribe, given up for adoption, and raised in a modern society would not be very different from those of its contemporaries whose ancestors had been living in state societies for long periods of time. It doesn't look as if hunter-gatherers are that biologically different from you and me. That may be wrong, but to the extent that it's true, it would suggest that there has not been recent selection for nonviolence.
I suppose the second part of that question I asked was about cultural evolution, which has been sort of the theme throughout our conversation, actually, about the people's morals changing, states changing, people around you. In the 10,000 odd years, biologically we might be the same, but cognitively, culturally, we're very different. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned, of course, reason and in that case, education and self-knowledge as part of the reason why things are moving in the direction they are doing. What's your prediction, if I can ask that, given that scientists don't like to make too many predictions, but what is your prediction for this trend? Is it going to continue?
I suspect it will, not necessarily all over the world, but I think the world's getting smarter. The world's literally gotten smarter in this narrow sense that IQ scores have increased over most of the 20th century and all over the world, the Flynn effect. But
On that, I noticed there was a fascinating thing in there about modern teenagers. For any parents who think that their teenagers are a bit lazy, to give them some hope.
Yes, a teenager today, if time transported back to the first part of the century, would have had an IQ of 130.
Yeah.
Now, by the way, it doesn't mean the teenagers of today know more. And in fact, in skills such as vocabulary and arithmetic, there's been very little improvement. But in abstract reasoning, in solving analogy problems, like tree is to seed as a bird is to, and you have to fill in the blank, a teenager today, it would be far better than his counterpart of many decades beforehand. Modern societies, that process can't go on forever. We're not going to get, our IQs aren't going to just increase linearly indefinitely. But in societies where they were lower to begin with, I think we can expect to see continued improvement because the Flynn effect is driven by two trends that are likely to accumulate in the developing world, namely education and the trickling down of scientific and analytic concepts into everyday discourse through literacy and media. There's no reason to think that won't happen elsewhere in the world.
Does technology help as well? I mean, with the web, people see other people's lives much more easily and they're more able to connect with people all around the world. So you see yourself as less different. So therefore, treating someone else in a sort of inhuman or alien way is you'd be more thoughtful about that.
I suspect that that has happened well before the development of the web. I suspect that that happened in the 18th century with the rise of print and literacy and affordable books and popular fiction. I think it may have been taken to a new level in starting in the 1950s with the rise of television and transistor radios, where it was said that we lived in a electronic global village even back then, and it might be taken to the next level by the internet. And there are reasons to think that with each one of these technological developments, there was on its heels an advance in humanitarian sentiments. So the rise of literacy and printing in the 17th century could have led to the humanitarian reforms of the Enlightenment in the 18th century, such as the abolition of breaking on the wheel and slavery and despotism and so on. It's not implausible that many of the anti-war sentiments of the 1960s were helped along by footage of the Vietnam War being brought into your living room in real time. Civil rights movement, it's harder to think of blacks as inferior when you see them, hear their words on talk shows and in popular entertainment. And it's quite possible that social media and the internet will have a similar function throughout the world in the 21st century.
Now, you say you wrote the book in response to a question. I think this is one of John Brockman's annual questions. He asked a few years ago, what are you optimistic about? And many people answered in very different ways. And your answer was this 800-page book.
It was 800 words that grew into 800 pages.
It
yes.
grew into this.
Yes.
So this magnificent book. Are you still optimistic after having written all of this?
Yes. Although, as I explained in the book, the attitude is more of gratitude than optimism, in that you have to be humble in making predictions about the world as a whole. Experts have often been humiliated or ought to have been humiliated by confident predictions that have turned out to be false. On the other hand, we do know with much greater confidence what has taken place retrospectively. And a lot of good things have happened, and we ought to be grateful for them and ought to work hard at identifying their causes.
Huge thanks to Steven Pinker there. His book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, is out now. Remember, you can also download the full edition of Science Weekly. This week, we've got explanations of quantum levitation, and there's more from Professor Lawrence Krauss on our place in the cosmos. Also, you can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time, of course, on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly Extra producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.